Meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division will come to order. A quorum is not yet present. We will proceed with the Board of Governor's recommendations for the Board of Soil and Water Resources. And when we do achieve a quorum, Mr. Jashke, we will do the minutes once we get that, just to get that done. We have two sets of minutes. So, Mr. Jashke and Ms. Becker-Kadelka, welcome to the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm John Jashke, Executive Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources.
And Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with Bowser.
So we're just going to walk through a short introduction and then get the budget item specifically closer to the end of the presentation. So I'm just going to put my head down and go, and you can ask questions whenever you...
Well, we did hit a quorum, so I'm going to just do the... Representative Fisher, did you review the minutes for March 12th?
Yes, I do, and I'd like to move the minutes from March 12th, please.
Representative Fisher moves the minutes from March 12th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Representative Lewick, did you review the minutes for March 14th?
So moved.
Representative Lewick moves the minutes for March 14th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Minutes are approved. Mr. Jashke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. So we'll give a little introduction on our agency operations, and then I'll have Angie cover most of the dollar amounts that are in the budget proposal from the governor.
Get a little closer to the mic, Mr. Jashke.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chairman, John Jashke, Executive Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources. Our agency is, our budget is, as you're going to see here in a minute, largely executed through local governments, through local partners, and you can see this reflected in our mission statement here, which is to work to improve and protect our water and soil resources by working in partnership with local organizations, and all of that typically ending up in on some private land somewhere in the state of Minnesota for the public benefits that you'll see these programs provide. Again, it's a lot of it is about getting projects on the ground. Locally led is really an important part of this. Because we're working on private land, having landowner and community understanding and buy-in for these projects and practices is really critical. We also oversee a few regulatory programs that have, again, local implementation components at the county, soil and water conservation district, watershed district, or even in a city, or joint powers of these organizations at the local level. We also oversee and run a state conservation easement program since the mid-1980s called the Reinvest in Minnesota program. And we'll talk more about the results and how that program works in a minute. And making sure that these resources and activities are done in the most effective manner involves picking priorities and targeting those dollars and efforts to the most critical landscapes that are going to give us the best public benefit. Again, we focus on the private lands of the state. Here's a map just showing, the private lands. Obviously, most of the public lands are in northern and eastern, northeastern, north central Minnesota, and we know how those are managed through the state agency and the federal agency, primarily in the forest area. We also can see by this map, the waters that we have pollution problems on are reflected of primarily agricultural land in some parts of the state, urban land in other parts of the state, but private land in general is associated with more of our water quality challenges. Again, we use that local government delivery system that allows people who are experts and persons who are part of the community to work on these projects and programs.
So, Mr. Chair and members, for fiscal year 2021, the governor has recommended a budget of $175.9 million for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The pie chart shows that the majority of this is through Clean Water Fund dollars. We also have included the Outdoor Heritage Fund as a piece. It represents about 12% of our budget. Even though the governor doesn't recommend that, we show it here as part of our entire budget package. The general fund then rounds that out with about 17% of our resources. As Mr. Jashke said, we are a lean agency because we're focused on getting resources out the door. And so local government conservation delivery is Minnesota's model for getting conservation on the ground. About 83% of our budget goes directly out the door to local governments for implementation. And then the agency program and development and operations are the other 17%. By program area, this is a little over half of our budget is for local water and local land and water conservation. Almost 30% is for permanent resource protection. Some of our statutory resource protections, which I'll get into next, cover about 7%, and the agency operations are the last 7%. So if we start with the statutory resource protection, this is our state support of the legislation that Bowser is directed or mandated to work on, including the Wetland Conservation Act, drainage law, buffer law. We have asked for no change items in this section of the budget. The Natural Resource Block Grant is one way that many of these programs get done, and this is a block grant that goes out to the counties to work on things like the Wetland Conservation Act, on shorelands, and on water planning. As you know, the Wetland Conservation Act calls for no net loss of wetlands, and so first trying to avoid a wetland. Where one can't be avoided, to minimize it, and where it can't be minimized, to mitigate it. We are required by statute in 103B to facilitate drainage policy, and this is done through the Drainage Work Group, which is a group of very diverse stakeholders. It's agricultural interest, environmental and conservation interests, local governments, drainage authorities, and members of the legislature. We are also tasked with keeping up the public drainage manual.
Ms. Becker-Cadell. Mm-hmm. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Becker-Cadelka. So you're talking about working with the local groups like soil and water conservation districts, and are we going to get to in this plan on where we're at for funding the soil and water conservation districts?
Ms. Becker-Cadelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the funding for soil and water conservation districts first and foremost needs to be stable, and it needs to be predictable in the funding for the groups that get this work done on the ground. In the governor's budget recommendations, has put forward one opportunity for that, and that is through a levy authority, and that is in his in his tax budget, so it would be in the tax bill.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just curious of conversations with the tax chair in the House and the other body. Is there an appetite for this?
Ms. Becker-Cadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, I think one of the pieces that's very strongly agreed upon and known far and wide is that the work of soil and water conservation districts is critical to being able to achieve conservation delivery on the landscape. And so that, I think, first and foremost is trying to figure out where and how that funding will happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Becker-Cadelka, proceed. Oh, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question regarding the Soil and Water District employees. I've talked to a number of the local organizations, and one of their biggest expenses is health care for their workers. I'm just wondering if we could get them in a health care package at some point, but just food for thought right now. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, local governments are also autonomous units of special purpose units of local governments, which means exactly some of the challenges that you outlined with small local governments have a harder time sometimes buying into health care systems that are provide equal benefits and are affordable. And so I would say that is one of the ongoing challenges. The soil and water districts do have a couple of bills that are moving forward, including the a levy authority and a general fund ask for part of their funding.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, the last piece in our statutory obligations is implementation of the buffer law. When that passed in 2015, it directed Bowser for implementation pieces. And this is an example on the top of a 16.5-foot buffer on a public ditch. On the bottom is an example of a 50-foot buffer on a public water. thanks to our local soil and water conservation districts and to farmers across the state, we are now at 99% compliance on public waters for the buffer law. We're about 84% on public ditches. It was a really bad fall for harvest, and it was wet, and we expect the spring to be wet as well. The soil and water conservation districts are continuing to work with landowners on being able to get those final buffers in. So in summary, for our statutory resource protection, in implementing these laws, they're designed for greater efficiency and effectiveness. We want to make sure that we have improved landowner services and to have water quality and infrastructure improvements.
Under the local land and water conservation part of the budget, this includes several components, of which maybe the highlight is the fact that we have these local planning responsibilities by statute, counties, watershed districts, and soil and water conservation districts, and cities in the seven-county metropolitan area, or joint powers of those organizations, work together to develop water and watershed management plans that then these programs provide funding to execute those plans in part. Obviously, the state provides a part, the local organizations provide a part, and then they seek funding from wherever they can get it to do the rest. And so part of our responsibility is to review and approve those plans, and then also to provide the funding from the state to carry out that work via those plans. One of the change items in the governor's recommendations is for easement stewardship, which is for our Reinvest in Minnesota program. We have somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 or 7,000 easements that have been acquired over the last several decades, and we have to make sure that those easements, the state investment in that asset, is well preserved and well managed, and the public benefit is sustained on all those properties. Our conservation delivery and cost share program is really the one that kind of is in some ways the centerpiece for what the soil and water conservation districts in particular do. They work with landowners to provide two things, technical assistance and financial assistance, and this is really about putting those two things together. They're able to leverage funding from the federal government in many cases to help landowners, particularly in rural Minnesota, with the Farm Bill, be able to carry out that conservation work, you know, landowner by landowner, using the plan as their guide. Here's the watershed approach, which we're now moving towards via legislation that was passed now, well, in a couple of phases. Initially, I think it was passed in about 8-9 years ago, where we directed local governments to work on a watershed basis. That was evolved in a couple of different iterations to now, in essence, move towards by 2025, having the state using the watershed approach as the primary way of managing our water resources, following the scientific information that's been collected now over the last 10 years through those Clean Water Fund investments in monitoring and analysis. This is a little example here just of the easements that we hold in the state. Again, most of our easements are about restoration, so we acquire the conservation easement on the property and then put the land back into a conservation state. Most of these are wetland restorations or riparian buffers, or in some cases wellhead protection is also another one of the practices that are used under the USDA spec and state guidelines to get this land back into a conservation state. Again, aimed at the marginal parts of these landscapes. Again, this is done through the local soil and water conservation districts. They do the monitoring, they work with landowners, and we pass on those funds from the state, and they provide the technical and financial assistance. Again, that private landowner work is for the public benefit, because the way the land is managed, of course, is reflected in the way our waters are used and available for other uses. There are several iterations of this program, our Reinvest in Minnesota program. We talked about wetlands and riparian buffers. We also use this program to protect existing areas around some wild rice lakes in north central Minnesota. As I mentioned before, we use it for wellhead protection and shoreline protection in more limited cases. And we also have an arrangement with the area around Camp Ripley to bring in some federal funding to do additional work specific to protecting that area around the military installation. I'll talk about that in just a second, a few pictures. But we use these various funding sources, all are combined in these various programs. Bonding funds have historically been used, Clean Water Fund, Ultra Heritage Fund, and federal funding, all come together to acquire the easements and do the land restoration or protection. There's no change to this. This is an example that an Army compatible use buffer program that we carry out in conjunction with obviously Camp Ripley, and it's also a role that the DNR plays in this as well when they do some fee acquisition. Again, it's to protect the military operation from development that could otherwise occur around that base, and then allow or not allow them to do their military work, which requires a certain amount of noise and disruption that isn't compatible with residential use. But it is compatible with farming and other things, so that's those are development or those are activities that are allowed under these easements. We highlight the CREP program. A couple of years ago, we signed an agreement with the federal government to align our program with the Conservation Reserve Program. You can see here's the status of the funding to date. We are aiming for a $175 million state contribution over this approximately five-year time period that the program is expected to operate. And part of this money, of course, comes from the federal farm bill, which has been recently reauthorized in D.C.
The next category is agency operations, with the goal to provide quality, timely, and cost-effective support. So this includes all of our board operations, our administration, our accountability and evaluation, including the way that we manage our grants and that money that does go out the door, that 83% of the budget that does go out the door. Our budget has become more complex, and we have special revenue funds like bonding and all of our federal contracts that we need to manage. And those special revenue funds oftentimes come with restrictions that the general fund then must hold. So the general fund must provide certain administrative costs to carry those special revenue funds. As such, we have three change items to our agency administration and operations budgets. And so I'll go through those in detail right now. So the first one is the operations budget. So these are costs that are passed on to the agency via lease increases or retirement obligations. So, for example, the agency doesn't bank dollars for retirement. So these are actual dollars of people that are retiring that the state is obligated to pay out. It's also the base requirements passed on to the agency by minute and salary basis. The middle one is our fiscal services. This is the only place in our budget where we are requesting two additional FTEs. This really relates to the tension that we have between getting as much money out the door as we can and still meeting state requirements. And because of this more complex budget, the staffing levels have remained the same while we've had more and more projects and budgets to work with. The Office of the Legislative Auditor also identified this as an area where Bowser could use more staff to meet our existing fiscal demands, statutory obligations, and requirements. So this is asking for $170,000 a year for two staff. And the third one is the critical IT and security. We have been we've been stretching out our databases as long as we can. And so right now we have, for example, our wetland banking database that holds all of the credits for when private landowners and buyers buy and sell credits is operating on a platform that is no longer supported. And so we tried to find somebody in Wisconsin that still worked on a Fox Pro platform and have been informed that he no longer works on it as well. And so we are limping along and are well aware of the fact that if that goes down, there will be Minnesotans directly impacted immediately. So the benefits to these change items is really that it provides services to local government partners and to taxpayers to meet our existing obligations and to really fulfill vulnerable and outdated tools. We want to make sure that our operations are reliable for the agency and for our partners.
And then just to wrap up, Mr. Chairman, members, you know, this is a map showing, you know, the variety of projects and where they're located over the last several years. You know, the numbers, of course, you know, are maybe not so much easy to understand, but we do measure the results of each of them. And so I thought I'd highlight a couple of those just so you can see how that works. And so here's a here's an area down in Sand Creek. This is Scott County. In fact, I know they're having some flooding problems right now. So, you know, this work to stabilize this stream bank and protect that shore is, you know, a watershed project. You know, this particular project or this particular part of this watershed in this one project, you know, was accomplishing 20% of the goals for the water quality improvements in that particular small watershed. And obviously, you got to protect it for the events that are the big ones. You know, sometimes they come in the spring, sometimes they come in the summer, but you got to be ready nonetheless. Here's one that, you know, a much larger project, which included a channel that was once, of course, straightened out, you know, many, many years ago by the Corps of Engineers, actually, but now they help with putting things back as well. And so this was a project that had multiple benefits, where the channel was re-meandered to provide water quality benefits, habitat, and flood control benefits all in one project. In this case, you know, because it was a comprehensive project over that stream reach, we were able to achieve the 80% progress towards the water quality goal on that site. You know, these projects, you know, all of them, whatever funding source they come from, whether it's federal, state, or local, they do, you know, provide local persons with work, you know, whether that's through contracts or through staffing at the local level. But these are people who hired and are working in those local communities, and I think it's really important that those projects, you know, then get broader support because the people who are most affected by them see them happening. With that, Mr. Chairman, we will stand for any questions.
General Genius.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two different questions. On page 15, you talk about the number of phosphorus pounds annually. I assume that means phosphorus not going into the water. But I have no context here and don't know how much phosphorus do farmers apply each year, and is that number stable or is that number going up?
Mr. Jashke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guineas, I think I'm going to have to go back and get some more information from some other sources because I don't have it for this project. You know, this project was one that was designed as part of this watershed restoration work. The source of the phosphorus, it is an agricultural watershed to some extent, but it's also a watershed that has a serious amount of bank erosion as well.
I'm looking here.
Oh, I'm sorry. My page 15, oh, there, the top of this one? Oh, okay. This information comes from our database that Ms. Becker-Kadelka mentioned before called E-Link, where we include all the projects that are done within a given time period. We use estimators because, of course, we can't go monitor every one of them to make sure the number is specific to that project. We use estimators. The University of Minnesota has been part of validating, and so we plug those into these standard practices and make estimates from that.
Mr. Chair, if I could...
Representative McGinnis.
But that's not my question. I'm not challenging your estimates. I am saying I have no idea what this means because I don't know, we don't know how much phosphorus is applied annually. And the second question is, so what percentage is this? And secondly, is the amount of phosphorus continuing to rise or is it flat? So having a chart that shows us a purchase over the last 15 years would give us some sort of context. But without knowing that, this is, I think phosphorus is applied in the millions of pounds, but I'm not sure. So since I'm not sure about that, I'm hoping you will bring that information back to us. And if I could have one more question.
Representative Guineas.
My own watershed district, we're having problems with too much water. If I represent the choke point in the Minnehaha watershed district, where the whole watershed is flows through a tiny little lake called Lake Hiawatha. When we've been talking to the watershed district, it has become clear to me that they have not made plans for climate change. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in the pickle we're in. So, how are you incorporating into your planning process for everything climate change?
Mr. Chairman, we're part of an interagency group that is dealing with, you know, the whole climate change challenge. Specifically to how we incorporate it, it's really, I'll say, three areas. One is the plans themselves are, that I mentioned earlier, the watershed plans. They do include a component about how that climate change is going to be addressed through their authorities. And the second two things that we do specifically on the designs of these projects is we use both the updated engineering specifications, you know, that have to do with the hydrology, so that we design these projects to handle the rainfall events, the runoff events that we're seeing more recently compared to the ones that we've seen over the last prior decades. And on the biological side, we spec plant mixes that have the ability to adapt or handle over long periods of time, you know, climate changes. So those are the three things that I would respond to in a brief way.
Representative McGinnis.
I hear you're planning going forward. What about, I mean, my watershed district is particularly old. It's one of the first, I think. Mm-hmm. And climate change was not included in its original design. Mm-hmm. So what are your recommendations to watershed districts that are like that?
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, it's a really good question. And I think, you know, 10 years ago, our best modeling tools got us this far, got us to, you know, the pollution reduction estimators around tons of sediment annually or pounds of phosphorus annually. And as we learn more and as we keep moving forward, I think the component around One Watershed, One Plan, which is let's not just look on geopolitical boundaries, let's actually look where the water is coming from and where the water is going to, is going to keep making us better, make us better locally, make us better at a statewide level. And as local governments are now getting together to plan on a watershed basis, it's taking it to the next evolution, which is not just how many pounds of phosphorus or how many tons of sediment, but really what's the goal and how do we make progress towards that goal written in the plan. And so that's the piece of the plan that also has, as Mr. Jasky said, climate change adaptations so that they are prioritized, so that they're targeted, and that so that they have measurable results. And so, for example, this project in Sand Creek that Mr. Jasky talked about was recognizing that all of these things are going to get this creek 20% towards its goal, and I believe this was a goal for sediment reduction, 20% towards that goal. So recognizing it's going to take a lot of practices, and it's been a long time since these practices have been happening. It's going to take some time to fix them, but now we have a better understanding of what that goal is and how do we make our way towards it.
Representative Wagenius, and if you could just pull your mic up just a little bit.
Thank you. I think you're not getting, I'm sorry, I'm not making myself clear. We're having quantity water problems, just a lot of water. So around one of my lakes, they're doing the best practices of putting in nice plants that have deep roots, and they're getting flooded out. So we have a very basic too much water coming into too small an area problem. And this is an old watershed district. So my question is, what do you do about things that we did in the past, not thinking about climate change? How do we update that? How do we move?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGinnis, you know, the plans that Ms. Becker-Kadelka mentioned include not only water quality, but they also include water volume. They may include water supply. They may include recreation. They are comprehensive. That is one thing that's really important. In your case of Miha Creek, obviously, they've got a built infrastructure that's been there, as you say, for a very long time because it's an old developed area in that regard. They're going to probably have to use some special means, and their plan will be updated once every 10 years. And so I can go back and get you the information on when that next update is in front of them. But at that moment in time, they will be asked to include climate adaptation measures as part of their considerations in that plan update that the state will review and ultimately approve, hopefully.
Are there any other questions? Any other questions? Thank you. We'll move to the first bill, Representative Sandsteed, House File 838. I will move that House File 838 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Sandsteed, would you please present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm proud to represent my district, which is largely dependent upon natural resource-based economy. House File 838 is the result of my desire to bring much-needed economic development to my region by taking what I believe is the next step in optimizing and expanding the uses of our many natural resources in an environmentally responsible manner. Minnesota is home to 17 million acres of forest. Currently, only 5 million of these acres are being managed by the DNR. Healthy managed forests are critical to our wildlife, our water quality, economy, and recreation. We all know a forest is living and ever-changing. What this bill does is it appropriates $2.2 million from the general fund to the DNR for a transfer to the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota for academic and applied research through MnDrive at the Natural Resource Research Institute for the following purposes. $500,000 is appropriated to develop what is called a forest optimization tool. This is a compilation of evidence-based data and information used to enhance forest productivity and the benefits of a healthy managed forest. $800,000 is appropriated to maintain and expand the Natural Resource Atlas, an interactive resource tool that can be accessed by county, federal, state, tribal, and private land owners. The Atlas accesses more than 200 databases of information pertaining to all natural resources. It contains all the information needed to make informed decisions. Again, only 5 of Minnesota's 17 million acres are being managed by the DNR. The Atlas provides comprehensive information which aids in forest management for the other 12 million acres. The Atlas was designed and has been piloted only in northeast Minnesota, and this funding would allow completion of the Atlas development and the opportunity to extend it statewide. $400,000 provides funding to the Minnesota Forest Resource Council for ongoing biochar development and application of biochar to our forests to maximize forest health. Biochar is derived from components of a tree, like the chips and branches from the residuals, and it can be used to add value to our forest health when it's applied to the landscape. When biochar is applied to the soil, it delivers nutrients and maintains moisture levels and aids in the forest's ability of absorbing carbon. Finally, $500,000 is appropriated, and a portion of the $500,000 of this overall appropriation is going to be appropriated or being used, appropriated for the use of advancing emerging technologies to produce clean syngas. Syngas is the process of using forest byproducts resulting in a renewable liquid fuel. These liquid fuels are part of the emerging renewable energy economy and offer alternatives to traditional petroleum-based products. NRRI is working with 2 Minnesota companies currently to push these technologies forward. With me today, I have Dr. Rolf Weberg, Executive Director of Natural Resource Research Institute, to help answer any questions you may have.
Dr. Weberg. Any questions from Representative Eklund?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sandsted or Dr. Weberg, we've been asking for appropriations for the NRRI for doing this stuff, and I think it's very good projects that you're doing. What is your goal, final end goal for NRRI as far as appropriations go and that sort of thing?
I'll take a stab at this.
Representative
Sandsted. Ultimately, my goal is production, manufacturing of some type of renewable energy. We've been doing research for a very long time, and I personally believe Minnesota is positioned uniquely and perfectly to go to the next step to become a state where we can manufacture and be a producer of clean, renewable energies.
President Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I should probably be clear. I'm looking for what's the NRI's goal as far as the funding that they get. Thank you, Representative Sandstead.
Dr. Weaver.
Mr. Chairman, committee, first, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Ultimately, NRI's goal and role in the state is to deliver on the university's land-grant university status and drive commercialized solutions to the state of Minnesota. They may come in the form of a tool, as Representative Sandstead discussed, or in enabling technologies that allow us to see different opportunities at higher value as we go forward looking into the future. So we're mission-driven and delivery-driven for commercialization.
If you could just state your name for the record.
My fault. I apologize. I'm Rolf Weberg, Executive Director, the Natural Resources Research Institute of the University of Minnesota. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would recommend anybody in the committee in the Duluth area get a tour of this facility. It's amazing the work they do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Luke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In fact, I'd go even further. I don't care if you're in the Duluth area. Go clear across the state. it's a really intriguing place. Just a quick question on maybe you can help committee out to understand a little bit about the chemical compounds that are essentially available and can be extracted from a variety of wood products. A lot of folks think, well, we build houses and make paper, but there's a chemical and we make maple syrup and some other things, but there's some other things. If you just give us a quick look at what the potential is there for renewables.
Dr. Weber.
Mr. Chair and committee, I'll try to do that in 2 minutes, knowing that it'll take 30, but there are a number of things that NRI is pursuing right now. One, everyone has heard of lignin, which is a material that comes from tree processing. We have a new technology working with Oak Ridge National Labs that allows us to make some interesting biopolymers. So that is one extractable, to use the word that you indicated, Representative Luck. What's passing around right now are examples of different kinds of grades of biochar that we can process. Right now, we have the capability of making about 4 tons a day, which is industrially relevant. But it's different grades that you can use for different purposes, ranging from forest health to agriculture. It's also a way to sequester carbon and utilize some of these secondary species that we can't use today, as well as utilize some of the waste wood from our processing plants. Those are two major examples. The third that's in the bill, which is this idea of syngas. Syngas is really just simply decomposing wood materials into their most basic components, carbon monoxide and hydrogen. It's a little bit of a chemistry lesson, but in the Second World War, Germany figured out how to make gasoline and jet fuel out of that. The technology has come a long way since then, but two Minnesota companies have really have some groundbreaking technology that allows to do it at much lower energy and much higher quality. That sets Minnesota up for a differentiated opportunity. I hope that answers your question.
Is there anybody else who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone else? Representative Sandstead, any closing remarks?
I'll make those on my next bill, but I would appreciate your support.
I renew my motion that House File 838 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Representative Sandstead, House File 1321.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you just heard about one of the valuable resources that is common in my district, you will also learn that my region is rich in water and minerals. And again, it's my desire and goal to see these resources developed in a way that is environmentally responsible and helps to diversify the economy we currently know in my region. Like the bill you just heard, House File 1321 appropriates $2.4 million from the general fund to the DNR for a transfer to the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota for Academic and Applied Research through MnDrive at the Natural Resource Research Institute for the following purposes. $800,000 of this appropriation would be used to continue applied research to advance water quality technologies. $700,000 would be used to initiate a project that evaluates the existing iron minerals and develops processes on how to use them for ongoing iron production in the future. $500,000 would be used to demonstrate emerging mineral extraction technologies that support high-value mineral product development using a low-energy, low-water use approach. $400,000 would be used to utilize, develop, and repurpose existing mine landscapes, such as our water pits, into high-capacity, low-cost energy storage. This offers an opportunity for Minnesota to become a leader in renewable energy storage. And again, I'm happy to answer any questions.
First, I will move that House File 1321 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Dr. Weber, comments? Any questions from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Sandsteed, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, members and Mr. Chair, there is a host of renewable energies that are emerging. I believe Minnesota is uniquely positioned to capitalize on these, given its rich base of forest, water, and minerals. Not only would the funding for these two bills be greatly appreciated, I believe it would be pivotal in advancing our state in clean and renewable energies. I'd appreciate your support.
I renew my motion that House File 1321 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you. Representative Bernardi. I will move that House File 675 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Bernardi, you have an author's amendment?
Yes, I do. It is DE2.
Representative Lee, would you like to move the author's amendment, the DE2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the author's DE2 amendment.
Representative Lee moves. Representative Bernardi, first, I believe you have an oral amendment to the DE2 amendment.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, I'd like to consult with you on that. It actually turned out good, like I thought. Can you just verify that? Is there something that you would like?
I think it looks good. We may want to just move approve.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do have a question. The Control Aquatic Invasive Species Under an Invasive Aquatic Plant Management Program. Do we want to make that invasive aquatic management program instead of plants, so it could be any invasive species?
Representative Bernardi, what I'd like is if DNR could describe their permits, but mm-hmm. we could maybe approve the DE2 amendment to get that in the shape you'd like, and then any potential amendment if we had advice from the DNR. So all those in favor of Representative Lee's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Amendment is adopted. You could introduce yourself and aim for the record.
Mr. Chair and board members, my name is Heidi Wolf. I supervise the Invasive Species Unit with the Minnesota DNR.
Ms. Wolf, I think Representative Bernardi's question was, is there an aquatic invasive species management permit, or does the DNR only have an invasive aquatic plant management permit?
We actually manage on other things in plants. So zebra mussels, for example, in a pilot project could be an addition to that.
And would the language on 1.6 be sufficient for that to occur?
Mr. Chair and board and committee members, I believe so.
Thank you. Representative Bernardi, to the to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Heinzman, did you have a question?
I could wait if it's necessary, but otherwise I just wanted to ask quickly. I see between the DE and the original language, we're eliminating watershed districts, cities, and counties. There must be a reason for that.
Representative Bernardi.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heinzman, this is the amount of money that we have here will be very effective with lake associations. It would be probably not enough funding to add the other applicants.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't disagree. I just was curious as to why the scope was being limited. And I guess it makes some sense, but I also like the flexibility. Just want to put that on the record.
Representative Bernardi.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I bring this bill before you from my own experience in the community in which I live, a lake that I grew up playing in and water skiing and fishing in and sailboating in has become infested. And my there is a need to help manage this infestation. And when I did my research to find out how to help my community as a legislator, I found out there wasn't any funding sources that actually could help. And this bill, working with lake associations, helps to build partnership and civic action. And right now I thought it was really interesting. We have over 500-plus Minnesota lake associations who donate about $6.25 million annually to the care of Minnesota's lakes and about 1.2 million volunteer hours. They already are investing in our state and helping to manage the problem, but they need to have partners with the state to help manage that. And so with me today, I brought, and I also want to mention that 40%, and you know this, you're the Environmental Committee, but 40% of Minnesota lakes and rivers are impaired. I brought with me today the association president from the Long Lake Association, and he's going to testify on the bill, and his name is John Brohammer. Thank you.
Mr. Brohammer, introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name's John Brohammer. I'm president of Long Lake Improvement Association of New Brighton and have lived on the lake for the past decade. Long Lake is located in Ramsey County at the northwest corner of 35W and 694. It's a 200-acre lake and has 140 lake owners and four easements that represent another 100 households. It's a lake that receives a lot of external pressure due to being one of the closest recreational lakes to the Twin Cities. It's also unique in that half the lake property is owned by the county by way of Long Lake Regional Park. The lake was infested with invasive species in 2015, and it spread aggressively, choking out shorelines, anchoring spots, and our channel. This isn't just a water quality issue, but it's also a safety issue, since parking spots in the bays get choked out and anchored boats get pushed into ski lanes. Our lake association mobilized and created a management plan that included funding of AIS treatment from our member dues, and we continue to do that today. The city of New Brighton understands the value that Long Lake provides to the community and has been a great partner in co-funding this. However, we've been unable to obtain any state or county assistance to support our efforts in maintaining the health and safety of the lake. Across the state, this burden falls on the individual lake residents that organize through lake associations to maintain our public water assets. Today, I ask that you approve this bill to provide support to lake associations that are working so hard to protect the lakes on behalf of our communities. Back to you.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much do you spend each year, on your aquatic invasive species management?
Mr. Chair and Committee, we spend $4,000 for our milfoil treatment annually. Additionally, we also contract with the City of New Brighton for public safety, which is about equal to that amount.
Representative Fabian.
And give me your thumbnail sketch of how effective you think your program is.
From when it erupted in 2015, we've been able to keep a steady grip on its spread and on the management of it. So we've worked with not only Lake Restoration Incorporated to do the broader lake treatment, but also homeowners themselves for their individualized treatment, and we've been able to keep it under control.
Representative Fabian. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what is the treatment that you do? I assume you're just harvesting stuff. But
no, it's not harvest. It's a herbicide treatment that we do in conjunction with Lake Restoration Incorporated. Yeah. We can only do, out of our 200-acre lake, we can only treat about 10 to 12 acres of it, just due to DNR regulations on how much can be treated.
Representative Bernardi, do you have another testifier?
Yes, I do. Jeff Forrester with the Lake and River Association. Yeah, you can say the name of your organization. That would be great, and I appreciate him testifying because I knew that this wasn't only an issue for my community. I knew it was an issue for people across the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Forrester.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forrester with Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates, and I want to thank Representative Bernardi for bringing this bill forward. You know, often when an AIS is discovered in a lake, the assumption is made that the state is there to help, because it was at one time, up until about, I believe it's 2 years ago that the grant program was zeroed out, but at one time, there was about $800,000 a year that went out to help lake associations manage the state's problems of aquatic invasive plants in lakes. After that was zeroed out, it's fallen completely on lake associations. So these are people, volunteers, that are spending their own money to protect the lake's assets. I'm excited about the idea that the state would be stepping up to support them in these efforts. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Forrester? Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Bernardi, any closing remarks?
I just thank you for hearing this bill. Getting our lake associations, supporting them and creating partnership really helps with getting the public and civic action and helping us take care of our resources that Minnesota has grown to love and cherish, and we need to come up with solutions to help solve the problem. So we're the great state that we intend to be.
I renew my motion that House File 675 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Members, the next bill on the calendar, we're going to jump to Representative Becker Finn's lands bill, because there's a testifier that is unable to be here this afternoon, or this evening. So I'm going to go to House File 1586.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1586, and I do have an amendment.
Representative Becker Finn moves that House File 1586 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And you have an A7 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A7 amendment clarifies the provisions regarding sale of surplus state-owned lands to tribal governments. Essentially, it makes it clear which tribal governments would have access to that sale, making it clear that it would be the tribe that's located where that reservation is located. So some other tribe from some other place couldn't step in to try to buy that land. So it's just making it more clear what that provision was originally intended to do. I had some feedback from some tribal attorneys, and I have an attorney here, Ms. Coons, if folks have questions about the need to amend this language.
Representative Beckerfin moves the A7 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Is there any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Becker-Finn, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1586 is the annual DNR lands bill. So as mentioned, one of the primary provisions in the bill is the access, the ability to allow the surplus state-owned lands to tribal governments to purchase if they're within their reservation boundaries. There are also several technical elements which I'm going to ask DNR to come speak to.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Susan Damon. I'm the acting director of the DNR Division of Lands and Minerals. So as Representative Becker Finn mentioned, this is the DNR's lands bill. There have been some amendments to it. The bill, simply contains a number of amendments. There is a technical change to Minnesota Statute Section 84.0273 pertaining to boundary line agreements between the state and adjacent owners. Current law requires publication of a proposed conveyance between 15 and 30 days before the conveyance. This amendment makes the law easier to comply with by changing the publication time to at least 30 days before the conveyance. There are a few provisions in the bill that authorize changes to law that will improve efficiencies in DNR's land sales. Those are sections 2 and 4, which authorize an increase from $50,000 to $100,000 of the estimated market value of surplus land before an appraisal is required. Section 3 reduces the number of state agencies or entities that the DNR must notify before selling surplus state land. Representative Becker Finn has already talked about the provision pertaining to the offer of surplus lands to federally recognized Indian tribes. The bill also authorizes the private sale of 3 parcels of surplus state land bordering water. Carlton County, there's a sale to the Fond du Lac Band. And Hubbard County, there's a sale to the county, and in Yellow Medicine County, there is a sale to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The bill authorizes the public sale of surplus state land bordering water in Cass, Kennebec, Otter Tail, and Wabasha counties. The overall fiscal impacts of this bill in the next biennium are estimated to be $174,000 to the DNR. There are also some provisions in the bill that were amended and authorize a private sale of land in Itasca County. This is tax forfeited land. It would authorize the sale to community radio of a tax forfeited parcel. There's authorization of leases of tax forfeited land by St. Louis County, and then there are also a number of tax forfeited private sale parcels that are authorized. Those are also expected to have some small fiscal impacts.
Any questions for Ms. Damon? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 13, section 20, lines 13.27 through 13.30 talks about the department determining the land would best be managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a WPA.
Ms.
Damon.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, yes, this is it's a parcel right now. It's a public water access.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you. I'm curious to know if the Yellow Medicine County, because of the difference in the way PILT would be taken care of and so forth, did Yellow Medicine County weigh in on this transaction?
Ms. Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I do not have that information. I can certainly get that for you.
Any other questions from Ms. Damon? Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I guess this is probably for the for the bill author. On the amendment where we made some adjustments for tribal governments, did you consult with the Dakota Sioux tribal governments as to whether they would want to be involved in this opportunity to possibly purchase land?
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did not directly consult with them, but my understanding is that the commissioner of the DNR did speak to all the tribes at the most recent MIAC meeting. This option to purchase applies to all federally recognized tribes. So it includes, Dakota, Ojibwe, all 11 federally recognized tribes in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and author Bill. We've specifically mentioned the Minnesota Chippewa tribe, and I understand there's, but I didn't see any mention of the Dakota Sioux, and I do know there are a couple circumstances where there is private property within, or potential property that could come for sale within two of their areas. So, but yeah, as long as this absolutely provides everybody a even playing field relative to all the tribes, I just was kind of taken back by mentioning one group but not another.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason that it's mentioned is that the setup of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe with the different constituent bands is unique, and it's making it clear that each of those bands is on the same footing with the tribes that are recognized not as part of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. So it's not special treatment. It's my understanding is that all the tribes are on board with this provision and happy to see the recognition moving forward.
Any other questions? There is an A6 amendment. I'm not sure who that is from.
Yeah, Paul Hedges.
Nobody claims the A6 amendment?
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, it's a A6 amendment deals in 12B with sale of some railroad property to help with the food plant in Albany. That's what the A6 amendment does.
So, Representative Becker, that's yours.
Well, actually, it's Paul Anderson, but I can if he's not here.
Oh, Representative Becker moves the A6 amendment. And Ms. Damon, do you have any comments on the A6 amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, as far as I know, the amendment is actually a MnDOT parcel that would be transferred, and the DNR has reviewed that. It does not impact any land that we administer, and we're not opposed to it.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do see that Representative Anderson is here. If maybe he can just for the record explain what we're doing here with this amendment.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members, yeah, this was heard in environment policy, and the language is from MnDOT themselves. It has to do with going through the city of Albany. The Kraft Heinz plant wants to expand, and they need about a 10-foot sliver to the back of the building. And it's a MnDOT rail easement, and MnDOT has agreed to sell to the city or to Kraft Heinz that about a half an acre is what they need to complete their expansion of that plant. And MnDOT testified at the policy meeting, and they were okay with it.
Any questions, Representative Anderson? Representative Becker renews his A6 amendment.
Mm-hmm.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Amendment is adopted. Thanks. Representative Becker Finn, to the bill, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone in the audience? Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say it's a good bill. It's maybe not the most exciting bill that we'll hear in this committee, but it gets some things done for our local communities as well as our tribal governments. And happy to incorporate Representative Anderson's amendment and the other amendments we've been able to put in that have support from the local communities.
Representative Becker Finn renews her motion that House File 1586, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Motion is adopted. Thank you. We will proceed back to the schedule. Representative Morrison. Representative Morrison, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that House File 1885 be
laid over for possible
inclusion in the division report. Thank you.
Representative Morrison, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1885 proposes increasing the watercraft surcharge from $5 to $20 over 3 years. The aquatic invasive species surcharge has not been increased since 1989, and only a few lakes were infested then, and there were only a few species to manage. Today, over 700 lakes are infested, and there are over 20 species of concern. The cost of boat licenses is very low. For the few dollars spent, boaters receive unfettered access to every lake with no inconvenience. Parking is included, garbage removal, safety patrols and enforcement, plus all of the water quality and work that is being done. Aquatic invasive species inspections and decontaminations are all free. In contrast, there are about 75 state parks in Minnesota, and a one-year pass to them costs $35. We're talking about a $15 increase in boat licenses spread over 3 years for access to over 3,000 access sites. This bill also provides more funding for the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center. Science is probably our best chance at eradication of aquatic invasive species and of prevention, yet the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center has had to operate on a series of grants and one-time funding. It's been almost impossible for them to commit to long-term research programs because their funding is uncertain from 1 year to the next. This bill addresses that. I do have one testifier who you have seen before, Jeff Forrester from Minnesota Lakes and Rivers.
Representative Morrison, I do have a question. Representative Backer.
Well, we can wait. Jeff.
Okay. Mr. Forrester.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forrester, Executive Director of Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates, and I'm here to testify in support of this bill. There's, really, in dealing with AIS, we're talking about partnerships, and this supports the three key partners: research at Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center. It restores funding for the Minnesota DNR, which is a key player in all of this, and again supports local action and lake associations who are kind of on the front lines. So thank you. I appreciate Representative Morrison bringing this bill forward, and if there's any questions, I'm
Back.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. How was the $20 come up? What, you know, that figure to go from $5 to $20? Was there just a number pulled out, or was there? That's my question.
Mr. Forrester.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at $20, the University of Minnesota will get the base funding that they need. So basically, they added up, I believe, if you add up the $15 a year, divide it by the 3 years, you come up with the core base funding for the University of Minnesota. You restore the funding that the Minnesota DNR has lost over the years as the AIS problem has gotten worse and their funding has remained flat, and restore the grants to lake associations, but at a lower level than in 2017. I believe it provides about $600,000 a year for lake association grants instead of $800,000, which is what it used to be at. So it's a little bit less, but the number was arrived at by looking at what the need was.
Mm-hmm. President Backer.
I appreciate that. The only concern that I would have, especially out in my neck of the woods with a lot, most people own several different watercrafts. Like my father has a boat and two jet skis, so because that's $20 per item, that gets to be pretty steep. I don't know if the author would think about a different fee, maybe go up to $10 or something like that. I know what you're trying to do, and I appreciate what you're trying to do. At the same time, as everybody's
it's coming out of the constituents' pocket. So that would be my only, that would be my main concern when we quadruple the price from $5 to $20. That's a big jump. Where they've got grants in the past, offset some of it with a price increase. That's just, that's a suggestion that I would share with everybody. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the timing of this is serendipitous. If you have a boat, you got your renewal notice not long ago. I wrote the check about 3 weeks ago, and that was about the same time. We have a large database of members, and I went out to 20,000 on this bill asking them about it. I received three or four people that said they had a lot of boats and they were concerned, and I got dozens in support. So that gave me some comfort, and I wonder, you know, I know you guys have been receiving emails on this issue and other issues, and so, you know, this would be the time of year when people would be most aware of what their boater registration costs were. So.
President Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad Jeff is getting some positive waves coming your way, because I'm getting a lot of negative ones. I have, of course, numerous nonprofit camps and other nonprofit organizations are going to be affected by this. My resorters, they're seeing costs go up just about everywhere they look. So in this governor's budget, so they're kind of like, well, it seems like it's par for the course. This is going to have a huge impact on some of these organizations and groups that I've mentioned in previous committees, and so I'm going to mention it again. And I'm hoping that the bill author and others would be willing to consider possibly two things. It's already been brought up. Number one, lowering this increase, and then the other side of that would be possibly exempting my nonprofits. And I've met some kind of negative resistance to that idea so far, but I'm going to keep mentioning it, and I'm curious today if there's been any more discussion about that.
President Morrison, or
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, I think that the fee increase, remember, it's spread out over 3 years, so, you know, it sounds like a lot in one lump sum, but if you spread it out over 3 years, it's not that much money. I think that's fair to say for most. And I think that we have to remember, too, that this is kind of a crisis in our lakes in Minnesota, and none of us is going to be able to swim or fish or boat in any of them if we don't stay on top of this AIS problem.
President Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the point that I've had to make, and I'm going to continue to make, is, say, for example, my Camp Confidence. They literally operate on donations and sponsorships for kids. And those kinds of organizations are going to have to pay more, and there will be kids that don't go to camp because they had to pay a small increase over 3 years. I'm not going to tell that family, your kid doesn't get to go to camp because of this. Now, they can go out and maybe solicit more donations, maybe it doesn't matter. But at some point, it does matter, and they are always filling up those spots. There's always kids that, at some point, they can't sponsor. This will affect families in a negative way in those situations, and I hope that the bill author would reconsider, because it is going to hurt some families.
Any other questions? Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrison, I'm curious to know, we've had, there's a lot of us who serve on both the policy and the finance committee, if you know, any members or any of these groups have come to you with suggestions for ways to address some of those concerns, or if it's just, you know, it's like we can angry tweet at each other and not come up with solutions, or we can, you know, work together on what, on addressing the actual concerns without taking down an entirely, you know, overall good idea.
Morrison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beckerfin, and members, Representative Heinzman did address this concern in the policy meeting as well. I have not had other conversations with other organizations or groups about this issue. I am open to figuring out how we can best address our AIS crisis, and obviously the intent is not to hurt the nonprofit groups in your district. And we can certainly have a conversation offline and see if there's something that we can do to support those groups. But boats are the vectors for AIS. I mean, we've pretty much conclusively shown that in the science. And so I think it's boats are a natural way to help us address the issue.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to follow up, just to give a little perspective, you know, we talk about boats, but the bill talks about watercraft. So what watercraft, what's the definition? Can we get a list of the watercraft that are going to be impacted by this surcharge?
Representative Morrison or Mr. Forrester?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my understanding that it would be any watercraft that you would have to buy a watercraft license for.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's why I asked for the list, because I think a lot of people would like to see what do you have to buy a license for.
Representative Morrison.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm sure that list is available because we people are purchase boat licenses every 3 years, so I'm sure we can get, I don't know if there's someone in the audience who could address the list question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, perhaps Heidi Wolf, who is here, can answer that question.
Ms. Wolf.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that list does exist. We don't have it here. We'll certainly get it to you.
Any other questions? Anyone from the audience would like to testify for or against the bill?
Mr. Chair, can I?
Representative Fabian. Point?
This is the surcharge here, but I think in DNR's, the governor's budget request, there's also a fee increase that would go to the water rec account on against watercraft as well, right? Can we get some? What is that going to be per craft? Can someone from DNR or Mr. Okay?
Ms. Wolf.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the governor's budget includes an increase on the watercraft surcharge from $5 to $7.25.
Representative Fabian.
Per year. Over a three-year period, correct?
Over a three-year period, correct.
Thank you.
Any closing remarks, Representative Morrison?
Thank you for hearing the bill. I think this is a simple, low-impact way that we can help to address our aquatic invasive species problem. Thank you.
Representative Morrison renews her motion that House File 1885 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Representative Lippert.
Thank you.
I will move that House File 1299 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Lippert, do you have, we have three amendments in our packet. Is the A3 the one that you would like to move? Like us to move?
Which is the, I don't have those amendments. The climate study one is the one to move.
Representative Lippert, why don't you describe the bill and we will try to figure out which amendment we're moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1299 has a goal of planting 1 million additional trees in each of fiscal years 2020, 21, 22, and 23. This bill aims to plant trees for two interrelated purposes. The first is to sequester carbon and respond to climate change. A Nature Conservancy study released in November in the journal Science Advances spoke of natural climate solutions. It found that managing the nation's landscapes with carbon in mind can cut greenhouse gas emissions by as much as 21% nationwide, as much as that's equal to taking all cars and trucks off the road in our country. Minnesota was identified as a state with great potential for net carbon emissions reduction through natural climate solutions. We could potentially reduce our net climate emissions by one-third through managing our landscapes. And one natural climate solution for Minnesota includes replanting forests. And so this bill seeks to work on this important area of climate response that's equal to transition to renewable energy and electrifying the transportation system. This bill also seeks to respond to the emerald ash borer crisis. We heard in the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee that we will be losing all our ash trees. And so we want to get out in front of this crisis, both to be maintaining the important ecological benefits of our ash stands and also to be maintaining the carbon sequestration that those current ash stands are providing for our state as well. Forrest Bowe from the DNR is with me today. This initiative is not in the governor's budget, but we've been working very closely with the DNR to put together how this concept would work, and so he can talk through the details of this bill for us.
Representative Lifford, I will move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Bowe.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Forrest Bowe, Director of Forestry with Minnesota DNR. Representative Lippert has asked that I run through the bill kind of at a high level. I also have some comments, and I believe some other testifiers as well. So, first of all, Section 1 talks about or allows DNR to sell seedlings in smaller quantities than we're currently able to do so. Section 2 of the bill actually starts to state the goal, planting 1 million trees each year for the 4 years to provide carbon sequestration and improve forest health. Section 2, Subdivision 2, speaks to improving seed extraction processes at our state forest nursery, developing native seeds appropriate for the climate, and design and construct cold storage facilities to store those seed and seedlings. Section 2B provides funding to produce container-grown trees when appropriate on state lands. Again, another climate change issue here. Subdivision 2, Section C, appropriates money to enhance and rehabilitate what we'll call non-productive state lands. These are state lands that are currently in a state that they wouldn't allow a timber sale. The production would be so low. We've tried to sell those, and we really need to rehabilitate the site. We could wait 50 or 100 years for trees to come back, or we could rehabilitate the site now and replant and get a forest growing there sooner. Subdivision 3 talks about private lands, increasing the outreach to private lands. Subdivision 3B talks about planting additional trees on private land with private landowners through a cost share program. Subdivision 4 talks about our emerald ash borer response. Basically, Subdivision 4A and B is taking some of those ash stands, trying to do something with those now, identifying where those are, converting those ash stands to be something more diverse and climate adapted into the future.
Do you have another testifier, Representative Lippert?
I have a few comments on the bill now that I've walked through. So first of all, I thank Representative Lippert for the interest in planting more trees. That's always a good thing. Really, this bill has all the right components to meet that goal of planting trees 1 million per year so that we can sequester more carbon. We have done some calculations, and we expect that the carbon benefit of planting 4 million trees or 1 million trees per year will be somewhere between 500,000 to 1.5 million tons of carbon dioxide over a 70-year period. What does that mean? So for every million trees we plant, we take the equivalent of about 750 cars off of the road. And as Representative Lippert had stated, this is just but one of the climate solutions that we could have here in Minnesota. Of course, in order to produce and provide the seed and seedlings, there's some improvements that we'll need to our nurseries, the seed extraction processes, making sure we have those appropriate climate-adapted species, climate-adapted seeds, and, of course, to store those. And in addition to those seed extraction investments, the bill calls for investments in our DNR nursery to begin production of a plug or a containerized seedling for use on state lands. Since we started working with the author on this bill, we have learned from the nursery, Minnesota Landscape and Nursery Association, that there may be some capacity right here in Minnesota. We had lost that in the past, and currently we're going through some partners in Canada to grow some seedlings. We think we can do that better right here in Minnesota, and we look forward to more investigation with the Minnesota Landscape Nursery on that piece of this.
Thank you.
If we could have those other testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I invite Jim Manolis to come forward, too.
Welcome.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, Chairman Hansen and members. My name is Jim Manolis. I'm Forest Conservation Program Director with the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota. And the Nature Conservancy is an international organization with the mission to conserve the lands and waters on which all life depends. We work to attain that mission here in the state through our work to restore and protect native prairies, freshwater resources, and forests. So I'm here today to speak in support of the goals of House File 1299. Recently, and as Representative Lippert mentioned, Nature Conservancy released a report on the natural climate solutions for the United States. And this report highlights how land management can help store carbon and mitigate the effects of climate change while also providing many other benefits for water quality, flood control, soil health, timber products, and wildlife habitat. So in Minnesota, our forests are changing. Some tree species may not be suited for a changing climate. And for this reason, we support accelerating tree planting and reforestation with resilient native species. And this really does mean that we need to increase the supply of our seedlings, and as called for in this bill. In addition to reforestation and planting on public lands, we also support additional efforts to work with private landowners to provide incentives for encouraging planting and nurturing our forests. And we need to prepare our forests to be resilient to climate change, as well as pests like the emerald ash borer. And we support the efforts to diversify those ash stands and mitigate the impacts of the emerald ash borer, especially in our northern forests. It's not just an urban issue. As an organization whose work is driven by science, we like to see, thinking about these issues, using a science-based prioritization to determine where we do reforestation, planting, and conversion sites. And selecting the sites, we would like to see an emphasis on areas that are most resilient to climate change. And we appreciate that this bill seeks to better understand carbon potential in Minnesota's forests. It sets us up to help identify which practices will further help us to mitigate carbon emissions. And the bill is a step in the right direction that's needed to keep our forests intact and equip forest stands to be resilient for years to come. And so thank you, Representative Lippert, for your efforts on this bill. And we look forward to continuing the conversation about preparing Minnesota's forests for what's ahead.
Any questions for the testifier? Thank you. Yeah. Any other testifiers, Representative Lippert?
I have no other testifiers.
Oh, I think you do.
Oh.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Forrest Sear. I am the Government Affairs Director at the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. I want to thank Representative Lippert for bringing this bill forward, and the other bill sponsors, of course. setting statewide goals for planting and carbon sequestration opportunities, as well as the health of the forest, is vitally important. And we're also encouraged to see money for EAB in the bill. That's a priority for my association, and we're going to keep fighting for it. So, however, we do have some concerns with the appropriation to expand the state's nursery to provide for the seedlings for the planting. MNLA encourages the committee to consider using existing private industry capacity for producing container-grown trees rather than expanding the state's nursery facilities to produce the required seedlings. MNLA hopes that the DNR can expand their opportunities to enter into contracts with private nurseries and to hit the goal of 1 million trees planted per year. So I'm happy to take any questions if you have them. Thank you.
President Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I had that in my notes to ask questions about what is the capacity in the private sector already. We've had this conversation over the years with regards to, you know, the state actually going into competition against the private sector and the jobs that are created there. Maybe between you and Director Bow, we can have a little bit more conversation today, if there's time, just to find out where really the taxpayers' dollars should be going.
Mr. Sear.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, thanks for the question. Right now we are reaching out to our large nursery operations that are looking at their capacity. I know that they are eager to fill this kind of need. And some staff within the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association are surveying currently, so we can provide feedback on that.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Bow, can you describe for me DNR Forestry's relationship with the private sector and how you probably work back and forth with each other?
Director Bow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I can describe that. I think we have a very good relationship with the Minnesota Landscape Nursery Association. As a matter of fact, I met with them just a couple weeks ago and kind of put out this plea that this company that we're using to grow our containerized stock in Canada is just not performing well for us. And in the past, we had some growers here in Minnesota. They no longer were able to meet our needs. A couple of them had sold their business, gone out of business, and so we had kind of moved on to the Canadian folks. A couple weeks ago, we heard from the Minnesota Landscape Association that there might be some renewed interest, and so we're really interested in seeing if that will work again. And sounds like there is some availability there. We grow, I want to say, about 6 million seedlings or package 6 million seedlings for sale annually. About 4 million of those, I believe, we grow ourselves, and we purchase the other 2 million. Would that be correct? I just happen to have my nursery manager here today, so if anyone has any questions about our nursery operation from kind of one end to the other, this would be a great day to ask those.
If we had a little more time.
Yeah. Okay.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's why I said that earlier. So, Director Bow, a million trees, two mature forest over 50 years, how many cords of wood does that yield? And it's not a gotcha question. I'm not doing that to you. You know me better than that. So
wow.
You can get back to me with that.
I'm curious. I will get.
Yep.
How do we... There's a favor. Why don't we, Representative Eklund has two amendments, and if we can get those done, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Representative Eklund moves the A1 amendment. You want to describe the amendment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The goal of this amendment is to increase carbon sequestration via planting the trees. As written, the bill does not currently require this assessment and reporting. Minnesota Resource Council has previously conducted a similar assessment and has unique capacity for additional assessment related to forest management and carbon sequestration. I have talked to Director Bow about this, and the DNR is all right with this amendment. As far as doing that, they believe another study is fine.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you for bringing this forward. As we move along with this, one of the I think we could have help out with a better definition of the scope of this because one of the things that's missing, I think anyway, is we've got an estimation of the changes in carbon sequestration likely to result from the loss of forests associated with emerald ash borer, but no estimation of lost from climate change. And that is a piece of a puzzle that would need to be put in here, making the scope better.
Representative Lippert, what do you think of the A1 amendment and continuing to work on things?
I support the A1 amendment and would be open to working with Chair Wagenius on incorporating her suggestions as well.
Representative Eklund?
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The A1 is adopted. A2, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment was intended to ensure that we gain the input and guidance on emerald ash borer research that has been taking place for the past 8 years through the LCCMR and other areas. This research has been looking at mimicking the potential impacts of emerald ash borer on our forests and their productivity. At this time, after some conversation with the DNR and others, I'm withdrawing the amendment as it seems in its current form, this language creates more of a barrier for the state than is written. However, even though I am withdrawing this amendment, I would appreciate, Mr. Chairman, if we agree that going forward and the research related to the EA emerald ash borer replacement species be part of the DNR's work.
Representative Lippert.
I support the comments of Representative Eklund.
Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? I renew my motion that House file.
Mr. Chair, before you do that, I just wanted to point out that there are some policy provisions in the bill. It hasn't been to the Environment Policy Committee. Section 1, obviously, I think deals with policy. It hasn't been there. And there's no Senate companion. I'm not sure what the path of this bill is, but it doesn't seem to me like it met deadlines with regards to policy. So I'm just pointing that out to the author.
I renew my motion that House File 1299 be, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Bill is laid over. So, members, the route when we come back at 5 is to do House File 2015, and after that is completed, then we will do the Clean Water Legacy. And with that, we are in recess. I will reconvene the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division to order. Representative Liz Lagarde, you look eager and ready to start, so I'm going to move that House File 2015 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Liz Lagarde.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 2015 provides a state response to the growing problem posed by the emerald ash borer infestation. We have learned a great deal about what communities in Minnesota are currently facing and what all of us are going to face as the EAB expands its range across the state. We have a number of communities on the eastern side of Minnesota, including metro area, who are already dealing with the expense of removing and replacing ash trees that make up a significant portion of urban canopy. This bill identifies jurisdictions that will be eligible to seek funding through the EAB response program to be administered by the Department of Natural Resources. The bill also indicates the type of work that will be appropriated for program funding. I have with me today a number of witnesses who can speak to this bill and answer any questions you may have. First, I have County Commissioner Victoria Reinhart from Ramsey County.
Ms. Reinhart.
Thank you. Yes, I am Victoria Reinhart. I'm a member of the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and I currently serve as chair of the Partnership on Waste to Energy, which is Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties. And I'm also here speaking on behalf of, in support of this bill, on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I know that you're on a tight time frame, so I think you all know that emerald ash borer is a big problem. I'm just going to go with that. And that there are three categories, and I'm only going to touch on one then, is tree removal, tree replacement, and wood waste management. Counties in Minnesota are responsible for waste management, including trees. And so that's the part that I'm going to talk about. If you have questions about the other, I'm open for it. We estimate that in the metropolitan area, there will be over 1.67 million tons of wood waste requiring disposal as a result of emerald ash borer. And I know that there's been a lot of questions about, well, why is this different than Dutch elm disease of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s? And there's some big differences. One is that wood waste now cannot be buried in landfills. It's banned from there, nor can it be placed in the trash, and open burning is not allowed. There aren't very many markets for this, for using products, but for mulch, I should say, but those are quite limited. So the most reliable way to currently manage wood waste is using biomass energy plants, which produce energy for heating and electricity. And this bill would support the necessary market. Without the reliable market for wood waste, we could see stockpiling, and that carries a big risk of spontaneous combustion, which is what happened when we had huge piles of Dutch elm wood disease, or diseased Dutch elm. It burned in St. Paul and created hazardous smoke for many months. And there are just few legal ways to deal with it, and I think we can expect that there will be more illegal dumping and of the waste. So, again, if you have more questions on this, I'd be happy to answer them, but right now I skipped over most of it and just would appreciate your support because we really need this. Counties cannot meet our goals for waste management without it, and this is a market that we need.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Also very grateful for the author bringing this bill forward and the committee taking the time to do it on a busy deadline schedule. The League very strongly supports this. I'm also here making comments on behalf of Hennepin County supporting it. They asked me to add their name to the list. Cities are the front line of where this pest is being dealt with right now. We've had some pretty extensive discussions in a number of committees. Just very briefly, in Minnesota right now, we have 17 counties that are under quarantine for emerald ash borer. That's every county in the east central part of the state and the southeastern part of the state, all of them. Martin County has just been added in the last year, and the southern third of St. Louis County, including the city of Duluth, is now under quarantine. So it is quickly becoming a statewide issue, and it will continue to spread. That's not going to stop based on what we do here. What is important is that this is a pest that if we do not slow it down, it can be financially impossible for our communities to deal with it. If you have a large percentage of the trees in your community, and you will hear about this later from one of our people who deals with urban forestry, you can have impossibly high costs that are suddenly hitting your city budget with no way to prepare for them. These trees die very quickly, and they are a real public safety risk when they do. And as I think people are aware, after the Dutch elm problems of the 70s, a significant portion of our boulevard trees and park trees were replaced with ash trees, and they will all eventually die from this beetle. So it's just a matter of trying to pace that out and potentially come up with some other solutions in the meantime. And for the next 5 years or so, the cities are where that's going to be happening. The real long-term issue, though, is our northern black ash forests, which are 900 million black ash trees and are a major part of the ecosystem of northern Minnesota that is what we're trying to defend right now and what we need to be ready to deal with before it becomes a crisis there. So that's why we bother doing this. That's why, even though it seems hopeless, it is something that we really do need to work on. Our cities are spending millions of dollars a year right now doing this on their own, and they're starting to fall behind. They can't keep up with the cost, and that's just dealing with the trees on public property without the ones that are on private land. So we need to deal with getting the inventory and planning done, getting the removal, replacement, and treatment of trees done where it's appropriate, and dealing with the disposal issues that the commissioner mentioned earlier. And we're going to need the state to be an active financial partner if we're going to pull this off. So we very much appreciate your attention to this, and thank you very much for the time. Happy to answer questions.
Any questions for the two testifiers?
We have Forrest both.
We should have somebody.
Representative Liz Lagarde, do you have a few more?
We do. Forrest Bolt could make it, so I have a different testifier. And she's eager to be here.
Introduce yourself.
Thank you. As you can tell, I'm not Forrest Bowe. My name's Amy K. Kerber. I work for the DNR Division of Forestry. So I want to thank Representative Lislegaard for bringing this forward. It's a very important topic. As you all know, the threat is real and it is serious. You heard, this committee heard testimony, I believe, about a month ago, on informational testimony about this issue. And you learned there, and I'll just remind you, that statewide we have 1 billion ash trees in Minnesota. We have the largest population or amount of ash of any state in the country. We look at the community level, that means 1 in 5 of our community shade trees, our trees in our communities, are ash. Puts communities at the greatest risk, and they right now have the most immediate significant need. So we've heard from communities in this committee previously, and then the DNR has repeatedly heard over the last couple of years from our community partners that they need a couple of things. One of those is that they need to do tree inventories. Basically, they need to identify where their ash is and how much ash they have. They also need to develop ash management plans. And then they need the financial assistance to actually do these inventories, to make the plans and implement them. And implementing the plans means treating ash trees where appropriate, so preserving those trees for as long as makes sense for that community, removal and replanting. And then they also need sometimes technical assistance for doing this, as well as caring for the trees that they plant after those trees have been removed. Ultimately, if communities are not able to have the financial needs and technical assistance to manage the ash and emerald ash borer situation, they will have communities full of standing dead ash. And if these communities are not able to manage it, that means they've increased the risk of spreading emerald ash borer to neighboring communities and then onto the ash forests in our state, which will have much broader environmental effects and impacts for us all to deal with later. Under this bill, the DNR is able to provide the assistance and support to communities to get this work done. And we know that this approach is a way for Minnesota to spread the cost to address EAB over several years and more easily absorb its impacts over time. We look forward to working with the bill author and partners as this moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Karen Zumach, and I am the Director of Community Forestry for Tree Trust. I am also the President of the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee, the state's tree board. I've been here talking with you and various members of your colleagues to talk about emerald ash borer for the past 5 sessions, so I won't go too far into the details except that EAB is indeed a big problem. We know that trees have value in our communities. The U.S. Forest Service has put together a really fantastic benefits calculator that really gives us those benefits of those trees in our urban and community forests. So when we're talking about ash trees, we're talking about an 18-inch ash tree, and that's going to provide about $168 worth of benefits to that community each year. Those benefits include stormwater benefits, stormwater mitigation, urban heat island mitigation, carbon sequestration and avoidance by providing shade and cooling, all those things that you just never really attribute quantifiably to a tree. And those benefits only increase in value over time. So when we lose a large amount of trees in a short period of time, there are significant environmental impacts. So I thought for fun, what I would do is take a look at each one of your districts and pick out a community in each of your districts. I have the rapid assessment data that was put together by the Department of Natural Resources in 2010 that gives a community a pretty good snapshot of what they have in their urban and community forests. So these are trees that are mowed around. We're not talking about forested areas. So for the committee members sitting around the table, I only counted Minneapolis once. Didn't want to skew the results. We're looking at nearly 300,000 trees, ash trees, in communities across each of your districts. So together, combined, we're talking about 300,000 trees, just picking one community out of your districts. So every community in Minnesota will be impacted by this. Small communities, large communities, some of those smaller ones have nearly 60% ash trees planted in their communities. Significant impact with very, very little support with a forestry department or a public works department. replanting two generations. It takes two generations to restore the tree canopy and restore those benefits after an invasion like emerald ash borer. We need funding to help communities manage this pest. We can't wait any longer. We can't wait for the day when it shows up in the black ash swamps of northern Minnesota. We need this funding now so we can really plan and manage this in a way that no other state has been able to do. I welcome your questions. I'm happy to share the data from each of the communities that I picked for you if you're interested. And thank you again for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers?
Okay.
Okay. Next testifier.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Huser and I represent Metro Cities. Metro Cities supports House File 2015 and would like to thank Representative Lisligard for carrying it. Metro Cities policy supports state funding to cities to address the local costs created by the emerald ash borer infestation. Many communities in the metro area are faced with growing costs related to combating the EAB infestation, and state sources of funding are needed to address this issue. Thank you for the opportunity to express our support for House File 2015.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone in the audience? Representative Lisligard, any closing remarks?
Just real briefly that I didn't know a whole lot about this issue until they gave that presentation in environment policy, and it really opened my eyes that this is a issue that is not going away and that we need to be fully engaged. So I think it's a good bill, and I think that it needs to move forward. And in short, a wise man once said, this is a really good bill, and you should support it.
Well, who's the wise man?
That guy.
Good advice. I will renew my motion that House File 2015 as amended, we didn't amend it, right? 2015 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Bill is laid over. Thank you. Representative Claflin will assume the chair.
Take it easy on him now.
Chair Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1928 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a re-referral to the Legacy Finance Division.
And Representative Hansen has the DE3 amendment. Representative Hansen, please present the amendment.
The DE amendment was posted yesterday. I'm going to go through a couple of things. I'd encourage folks to look at the 1928 original bill. The bill is about $260 million of funding from the Clean Water Fund, the Legacy Fund. Because of a decrease in the sales tax revenue, we had to cut about $1.5 million roughly from the that amount. And then the DE amendment changes approximately about $15 million reallocating dollars within the funds. I'm going to walk through kind of the changes. There should be a spreadsheet in your packet. The major changes are as follows. Forever Green was increased from $1.65 million a year to $5 million a year. The following items were removed. Technical assistance, academic research and evaluation, and vegetative cover and soil health. This is in the Department of Agriculture. On line 2.29 and 2.30, that appropriation to increase monitoring for pesticides and pesticide degradates, the DE3 amendment provides for monitoring for microplastics and nanoplastics. I want to note that we provide a definition in the bill for microplastics and nanoplastics. It also requires a report of this appropriation detailing the results of the monitoring and the assessment. On line 4.7, the Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program, the DE3 amendment requires a report detailing outcomes achieved by the program. On line 5.13, the appropriation for testing private wells for pesticides, the DE3 amendment also requires testing for microplastics and nanoplastics. So throughout the DE, there are increased monitoring for microplastics and nanoplastics after the report that we heard approximately 2 weeks ago about increased plastics in our environment. There are no changes to the Public Facilities Authority. On the Pollution Control Agency, the groundwater assessment was increased from $1.182 million a year to $1.5 million a year, and also requires assessing for microplastics and nanoplastics. The appropriation for completing the statewide assessment of surface water quality was reduced $1.2 million for the second year. The following items were removed: accelerated implementation of MS4 permit requirements, $450,000, and a public information campaign. We require a report back to the legislature on outcomes associated with enhanced inspections and SSTS. On line 9.4, we add language clarifying the grants for upgrading water softener units are for public facilities. On line 9.13 through 9.27, there's the language defining microplastics and nanoplastics and requires the MPCA to develop protocols for testing such. Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. The Forest for the Future was increased by $250,000 per year, requiring the Forest for the Future to be in the Mississippi Headwater Watershed for water quality while preparing for climate change. The following item was removed in the Department of Natural Resources: color infrared imagery analysis, $650,000. On line 10.4, for the Lake Index of Biological Integrity assessments, requiring assessments for microplastics and nanoplastics, and at least 50% of the assessments must be conducted in the metro area and in Rochester or Duluth. On line 10.11, when assessing for mercury, also requiring assessment for microplastics and nanoplastics. For the Board of Water and Soil Resources, targeted wellhead and drinking water protection was increased from $2.375 million a year to $5 million a year. It removes the reference to alternative management pools in the MDA Nitrogen Fertilizer Management Plan. The DEE-3 also increases the appropriation for the Technical Evaluation Panel to conduct at least 10 restoration evaluations by $32,000. The Conservation Drainage and Management Assistance was removed. Tillage and erosion transects were cut from $425 a year to $213 a year. $12.5 million in FY20 for the Conservation Reserve Enhancement was removed. The second year of $7.5 million in the second year appropriation remains. On subdivision R on line 16.21, making changes that the appropriations for Bowser are available until June 30th, 2024. Removes language allowing grants to be extended if the admin department determines a longer duration is in the best needs of the state. Minnesota Department of Health increases the Drinking Water Contaminants of Emerging Concern program by $7.542 million for the biennium, requiring developing and adopting at least eight health risk limits, requiring preliminary report by January 15th that identifies health risk limits and water quality monitoring protocols to be implemented, surface waters to be tested, and the list of contaminants to test for, requiring a final report on the outcomes by 2022. The DE3 amendment also increases private well water supply protection by $150,000 a year and adding microplastics and nanoplastics. The DE3 amendment includes $1.39 million for grants or loans for inflow and infiltration reduction programs. The University of Minnesota, the DE3 removes the $343,000 appropriation for clean water return on investment pilot and clarifies the appropriation on stormwater BMP performance is for municipal stormwater practices. The Legislative Coordinating Commission is reduced from $15,000 to $9,000. Legislative oversight, as similar to the Lessard-Sams bill that was passed, this requires the House and Senate Finance and Legacy Committee to convene a joint hearing to evaluate the effectiveness of the Clean Water Council and receive reports on the Council from the Legislative Auditor no later than June 30th, 2020, and every 4 years. On line 21.5, a technical amendment I'd like to incorporate, I think, has to be Clean Water Fund, not the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Is that right, Ms. Taylor? So.
Madam Chair, members, it should be Clean Water Fund instead of the Outdoor Heritage Fund.
So I'd like to incorporate that into the DE3 amendment. Article 2 contains provision from Representative Fisher's House File 875, which updates and modifies the state's Clean Water Legacy Act and related provisions, which was heard in Environment and Natural Resources Policy and the Water Division. The fiscal note notes $175,000 savings from the Clean Water Fund to Bowser for the biennium. So by including the Article 2 and sending that to Representative Lilly's committee, then that $175,000 savings can be booked to the Clean Water Fund. So in general, what we did is the DE amendment adds for sampling for microplastics and nanoplastics in surface water and groundwater. It cuts the first year of CREP and reallocates that money to drinking water and also for evergreen. There are some other changes that I could go into detail that I referenced of the rationale why some of those were made, but that is the DE3 amendment, and I would move it with the incorporated change for the Clean Water Fund.
Are there questions from the members? Heitzman, Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of things. Number one, I'm not seeing it. I'm sure it's here somewhere. What is the reserve in the Clean Water Fund? Do we know that? Somebody in health research probably does.
Madam Chair, Representative Heinzman, the statutory language requires a 5% reserve of the tax receipts from the last forecast. So this would leave a balance of $5,887,000 at the end of the biennium, which would be the 5% reserve. It can be found on line 98 of the spreadsheet. If that answered your question.
Representative Heitzman?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're making a few changes here, and I'm assuming there's been some communication with the agencies affected, and they're not. We don't need them to pile in, but just confirm, please, to the Mr. Chair, that there's been some communication with those folks.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Heinzman. Yes, there has been communication with the agencies. I talked over the weekend with the Commissioner of DNR, the Executive Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I talked with the Pollution Control Agency Commissioner, and I played telephone tag with the Commissioner of Agriculture by text and by phone.
Representative Heinzman.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. So just confirming, everybody was basically happy. They're not running down to say they have an issue of any kind, so I'm assuming they are.
Chair,
Madam Chair, I wouldn't say that they are happy, but I think they understand what we were doing, and I'm happy for them to testify and express their concerns. I'm sure they have some.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Chair, you talked about being in touch with the agencies and so forth. Appreciate that. Have you been in touch on the Senate side at all? Have you been in touch with them, or don't know where that's coming, or see what's coming down the path on that?
Chair Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Backer, I'm always looking forward to conference committees, but this would be Representative Lilly's conference committee that would be working with the Senate. So our task here is moving it forward, and I have not been in contact
okay.
with them.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions, or is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on the DE3 amendment? And please introduce yourself for the record.
Good evening, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Clean Water Council. The Clean Water Council is a group of 17 members appointed by the governor and makes recommendations for how to use the Clean Water Fund. There are certainly some intriguing ideas here, but the council has asked me to express its standing by its recommendations that are in the bill as originally introduced. It's not that there aren't some interesting ideas here. We don't have a monopoly on good ideas. But with 24 hours, we haven't been able to really parse out how all the interlocking parts will interact if you take one out and put it somewhere else. I'm not saying it couldn't work, but at the next committee stop, we'll probably have a more thorough analysis for that. This does reflect about a 9% change, or 9% of the recommendations are being removed and reinserted in different places. I will say there's only one new line item here. It's not as if there's ideas being brought out of the ether, so that's fine. And Representative Hansen has expressed some interest in some of these ideas, and as someone who's had experience in solid waste, the issue on plastics is intriguing. I don't know the technology behind the testing, but it's of interest. I just wanted to leave you and say that the governor's office did give me a call this morning and said that Governor Walz expressed interest in keeping the recommendations as submitted. But this is a different branch of government, so you may do as you will. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the areas I'm curious about, we're looks like we're going to make a significant adjustment to the amount of dollars that's available for CREP. Does that have a federal matching implication if it does? Do we have any numbers on that?
Chair Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Lewick, the state of Minnesota has been very generous in matching the federal allocation for CREP. I know that Mr. Hagemeyer has a spreadsheet of the appropriations where we've provided a Clean Water Fund, Outdoor Heritage Fund, Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, bonding dollars, Outdoor Heritage Fund, bonding dollars, and then more bonding dollars. So roughly, and Mr. Hagemeyer could correct me if I'm wrong, we've allocated or appropriated about $140 million. And by the House estimate, we've expended about $30, Mr. Hagemeyer?
Mr. Hagemeyer?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I do have a tracking sheet of all the appropriations that have gone to the CREP match. It's been $141,291,000 to date. Of the, it was originally $150 million match. That's $175 million for the roundout, so there'd be about $34 million remaining. The program has a 2.3-to-1 match from the federal funds to state funds. Based on information that the Board of Water and Soil Resources provided to the committee earlier this year, I think they've funded about 12,000 acres, and as an estimate, I think the state share is probably around $30 million on that, but Bowser could certainly correct me if that's a different number.
Representative Lewis?
A follow-up. So if we, it's pretty, you know, it would look like we're going to leave at least some federal dollars potentially on the table for now. Is there another place where that's going to be made up, or are we just going to forego those federal matching dollars, I guess?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and Representative Lewick, there is no end date on the CREP agreement. So the key point here is if we've appropriated $140 million and we've spent about $30 million, that's why I provide this. I took from the first year to give time for catch-up. I think we had testimony in the committee that because of the delay at the Farm Bill expiration and because of the government shutdown, that there was a pause in terms of things. So providing for the second year of the appropriation would allow the Board of Water and Soil Resources and landowners to catch up. And there is not the potential, in my understanding, because there is no cap of, like, this must be met by January 1st of 2020, that we have the time to either do this with clean water, outdoor heritage, or bonding. And we just, with the appropriation, the GO bond correction that occurred, that was $10 million more that just was appropriated in the last 2 weeks.
Representative Lewick.
Just, I'm never comfortable that the federal government's going to continue on as is, and they could take a sharp turn one direction or the other real quick, and but at any rate, thank you. I appreciate that explanation.
Chair Hansen, any comments?
I think there's another testifier.
And Representative Backer had a question as well.
Yeah, and then one more question, or two more questions here. I represent a huge area of agriculture, Madam Chair and Chair. What is the reasoning behind Line 5 and Line 6, the depletion of that to zero on your author amendment there, Chair?
Chair Hansen.
Representative Backer, are you on the DE?
I am. If you look on, I'm on our spreadsheet, Clean Water. If you're looking over to number five, technical assistance, the Clean Water Council recommendation had 1.6, 1.6, 3.2, and we have dashes, dashes, dashes. And then academic research, because I do know that research has played an important role in keeping clean water. We also scratched that out on the author amendment, and that's line six there, Chair.
Chair Hanson.
Madam Chair, and so I think, members, if you look at the actual bill, it would be on page 3.21, the 1.625 the first year and 1.625 the second year. So within the ag world, we're providing the money to Forever Green and targeting the Forever Green to work on drinking water projects as well as the research. The 1.625 the first year says for technical assistance, research and demonstration projects on proper implementation of best management practices and more precise information on non-point contributions to impaired waters for grants to support on-farm demonstration of agricultural practices. So these are demonstration projects and assessment and research versus doing the research for Forever Green and implementing those practices through the Forever Green program. On line 3.30, the 6.663 thousand is for the second year to research to quantify and reduce agricultural contributions to the impaired waters and for developing and evaluating BMPs to protect and restore water resources. So we have developed a lot of BMPs. The program where the dollars are going, again, is into programs, projects in the ground for drinking water. So in general, there's a lot more drinking water projects with easements for well water wellhead protection. That's where those dollars are. So we need a choice of, rather than continuing the demonstration projects and BMP development and BMP research, to do actual projects in the ground and targeting those for drinking water.
Representative Becker?
No further questions. Thank you. Right now.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to quickly check, is the Department of Ag here? Could they speak to this?
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record. And Chair or Representative Heintzman, did you have a specific question for them?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm assuming no agency is going to say, no, we can't use the money. But just in case, I'd like to better understand where 6.7 million would be potentially going with the Forever Green program and how you guys are geared up or not geared up to do that.
So thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Susan Stokes. I serve as Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I'm going to ask our Assistant Division Director, Dan Stoddard, to answer the question specifically about the program. But what I would say is similar to what Mr. Gardner said, which is we've had 24 hours notice, and we are happy to work with the author on this. But as of right now, we would want to stay with the governor's recommendations and the governor's budget. But Mr. Stoddard can explain a little bit more about the two programs if you'd like to respond on that.
Madam Chair, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. And as Assistant Commissioner Stokes said, I think we need a little bit of time to digest the changes. In general, we had requested an increase of $100,000 in Forever Green for implementation on the ground, and I think the recommendation now is $2.5 million. And then we did lose, or the proposal does delete our funding for two different areas, research and technical assistance. Both of those areas we think do provide value. Technical assistance in particular is really the primary funding source for clean water funds to provide information on agricultural practices to demonstrate and evaluate them in the field with the ag community.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That actually really helps. I'm trying to better understand, and that really shines a light on kind of some of the things that are going to potentially disappear here. What happens to those programs since they're eliminated from this line item, do those programs just completely cease to exist? Are there other funding mechanisms available? What happens to all those involved?
Mr. Stoddard?
Madam Chair, most of those programs appear like they will not exist anymore. Most of the funding for those demonstration projects is through the Clean Water Funds. We do have a lot of partnerships through these, so there might be some opportunity for partners to pick up some of those activities, but a great deal of the funding is through Clean Water Funding.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, follow-up. So just to be clear, those partnerships potentially could go forward, or are there going to be folks that are left kind of high and dry?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I guess we need to look at this a little closer to really understand the implications.
Representative Becker.
You're talking about these. Could you give us some examples of some of these partnerships that may go away and vanish?
I'm
sorry, Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative, technical assistance funds a number of activities that we use. Two primary things that we do is that we work with the ag community to demonstrate best management practice and other practices. And we also do extensive edge-of-field monitoring, which is a pretty high-tech thing where we actually have hydrologists install monitoring systems at fields across the state so that we can evaluate the actual impacts from different practices. That information then is used in field days. We have farmers come out. We work frequently in cooperation with a local unit of government or with Discovery Farms, their farmer-led work groups. And then we look at the practices. They can actually see the benefit of the practice, and it's really a wonderful opportunity to learn about what the practice does. And then we also have, as an outcome from that, very accurate information on what that practice will do in the environment. So that information is really hard to get, and we would use that information in modeling. The data is provided to other agencies, and they use the information to make sure that the assumptions that go in to the watershed restoration and protection strategies, or the One Watershed, One Plan strategies, is based on real-world data in Minnesota in different parts of the state. So we think the information and the effort is important and useful.
Representative Becker.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. And I've been at a few of those, so I would agree with you that practices are changed, and I'm concerned that we're zeroing that out in this. My next question that I have is on the academic research. What would be an example of a program or two that will disappear with it not being funded by Clean Water, potentially? I know you don't have a crystal ball.
Mr. Stoddard.
Madam Chair, Representative, so each year we come up with a new request for proposals. Those change. We have an interagency advisory team that makes suggestions. What academic research does, it provides accurate information on new and emerging practices and fills information gaps. So it's going to be a little different each year. But the information that we've generated through academic research has been really foundational for a lot of the impaired waters efforts in the state. For example, we've developed an Ag BMP handbook, which identifies the benefits of different practices. That handbook now is kind of the standard that's used in every impaired waters study to evaluate practices. One of the things that we're proposing is to do the same kind of handbook for groundwater. We also fund the Clay County Ag Drainage Site. So there's seven different replicated assessments of ag drainage up in Clay County. So we have accurate information on the benefits and the environmental impacts of drainage in the Red River Valley. So I think there's a lot of good work that's been done through academic research.
Representative Becker.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I appreciate you sharing that, because that is a concern. I would ask the governor's office would do what they can to keep those, because we know that roughly 20% of our state's income is from agriculture, and that makes a huge impact on our environment. So I appreciate what you're sharing, and would ask that the governor's office would fight for those programs through Clean Water. So thank you.
If there are no other questions, and there's another testifier. Chair Hansen, you had a comment?
Madam Chair, and just I'd encourage folks to look in their packet. There's an actual definition from the Constitution, and the Constitution says that if you've got a chance to take a look at it, 33% of the receipts shall be deposited in the Clean Water Fund and may be spent only to protect, enhance, and restore water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams, and to protect groundwater from degradation. At least 5% of the Clean Water Fund must be spent only to protect drinking water sources. So that's at least, not a cap. I would encourage folks to look at the constitutional language.
And for the next testifier, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris Alvrum with the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm here also representing the six state agencies at Met Council who received the Clean Water Funds. And similar to what Mr. Gardner and Commissioner Stokes said, we haven't had a lot of time to assess this. There are some significant changes, and the original bill was developed through a collaborative process with the Clean Water Council and the agencies, and the agencies still continue to support the governor's recommendations. However, as they said, there's some good ideas in here, and we'd be happy to work with the author to try to accommodate some of those and still maintain our programs that have been developed over many years. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this testifier? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill or the amendment? Representative Hansen moves the DE3 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
I would move House File 1928 as amended be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a re-referral to the Legacy Finance Division.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails. We are adjourned.